Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. China looms large, as usual, in our thinking about protecting the country we love. It has unfortunately become a nation increasingly bold as well as capable of waging war against this nation. Indeed, it has been for some time in the form of unrestricted warfare of the non-kinetic sorts, but increasingly the appetite for military conflict seems to be on the minds of Xi Jinping and his regime. And they're making little secret of it, including in the course of a series of high-level meetings with American counterparts. And to assess what's going on in those meetings, what the takeaway by the Chinese is from their American interlocutors, we're always delighted to catch up with the great Gordon Chang. He is, of course, an author of a number of really important books, including The Coming Collapse of China. He is an essayist of great renown as a senior fellow of the Gatestone Institute and at Newsweek, among other places. He is, very prominent in various media outlets, including, we're very pleased to say, this one, where we have him as a regular feature of our program. And of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, as I do. Gordon, it's so good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So talk a little bit about this series of high-level consultations with the Secretary of Defense and with the National Security Advisor. Their counterparts on the Chinese side have seemingly been very aggressive with them, and I'm interested in both what the message from the Chinese is and what message do you think they're taking away from their American counterparts?
The recent meetings with Lloyd Austin and with Jake Sullivan were contentious. And China's made it very clear what its position is. And we need to contrast this with the phone call that Xi Jinping had with Vladimir Putin on Wednesday, which, by the way, was Xi's 69th birthday, where they expressed support for each other, where China actually expressed support for Russia's positions on its sovereignty. And clearly that had a Ukraine connection to it. And this really indicates that essentially Russia and China have a partnership. They have an alliance. They say that it's closer than an alliance, although it's not a formal one. But we have seen China's all-in support for Russia on the Ukraine war. And this really is something that the Biden administration has not fully taken into account. The Biden team issues warnings, but never imposes costs for China violating those sanctions that we have had on Russia and for providing military information to the Russians. So this is the story. It's a story of American feebleness.
Well, I'm anxious to get your thoughts on this, Gordon, because all in is something I thought the Chinese were trying to obscure. I think you're right. That's what their actual policy is. But I thought that they were trying to be essentially on our side as well as on the Russian side, at least with respect to this idea that they weren't going to be providing material support to the Russians in their Ukraine operations. Are you saying that they actually are providing that material support and they're just counting on us to ignore that fact?
China has been financially supporting Putin's war effort with elevated commodity purchases. It has made its financial system available to Russian institutions that have been sanctioned by America and the West. Beijing has put its diplomats in the service of Russia. Communist Party and central government media outlets amplify these ludicrous Russian notions about the war. And there is open source reporting that China's been supplying location data to Russia because the Ukrainians in the beginning of the war were using Chinese-made drones. The Chinese told the Russians where the Ukrainian operators were, and Russia used that to target them. So that is military support as well. And with this phone call between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin on Wednesday, it's made it very clear that China is on Russia's side. The Biden administration, as I mentioned, is not willing to impose those costs on China. And it needs to do so because the Chinese will continue to go all in until we stop them.
You know, speaking of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky has used the platform of the Shangri-La dialogue last week, the place on the margins of which Lloyd Austin and his Chinese counterpart met, to issue a pretty strong warning that one of the lessons from Ukraine's experience has to be to provide material defense capabilities to Taiwan before it needs them, not after. Again, you mentioned that these conversations have been contentious. It's not just been, I guess, about Ukraine. It's also about Taiwan, has it not, Gordon?
Well, yes, because Chinese Defense Minister Wei Feng-he, the general, actually, in his meeting with Lloyd Austin on last Friday, and during General Wei's talk or speech on Sunday at the Shangri-La Dialogue, mentioned Taiwan, was very clear about it, that China would be willing to go to war over Taiwan. And, you know, it's not so much the words, which, of course, were hostile, but it was the emotion with which these warnings were delivered. You know, China wants to go to war. You can see that from what it does, from what it says. And that really is the takeaway. You know, we can just sort of turn off the sound and we can get the message.
Hmm. Yeah. And Gordon, to the extent that there's messages going both ways, what is your sense of their perception of the message coming back from Washington at this point?
I think they just ignore them at this point. A lot of people will say, Frank, that China was deterred from invading Taiwan because they saw the heroic resistance of the Ukrainians to the Russians. And, you know, I think that's probably true. But on balance, I think the Chinese were emboldened because on the other side of the equation, you know, China saw that the United States, the 27 nations of the European Union and Great Britain failed to stop Russia from invading Ukraine. And the reason why this is important is because those 29 states had an economy that was 25.1 times larger than Russia's in 2021, and yet we couldn't stop the Russians. That is a failure of diplomacy, perhaps the greatest failure, I think, since World War II. The Chinese saw that and said, well, if they can't stop the Russians from invading Ukraine, how could they possibly stop us magnificent Chinese from invading Taiwan? That, I think, when you look at all of the lessons that China has learned from the Ukraine invasion, that's the one that's most important. And on balance, I think they were emboldened, not inhibited.
Yeah, that's the key word that I was looking for, is whether indeed they are now feeling even more confident in their ability to work their will against the people of Taiwan. Gordon, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to just visit with you a little bit about what form this war might take on the part of the Chinese, if indeed they decide to go for it in Taiwan, whether it will be an encirclement and blockade leading to the reduction of Taiwan or actual, you know, invasion, and more to the point, whether it will be confined to Taiwan or whether the Chinese recognize that they're going to have to work their will more broadly, perhaps even including against us. We'll talk about that and more with the great Gordon Chang on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned for more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last month, the World Health Organization sought, with the help of the Biden administration, to secure sweeping new powers to dictate what constitute public health emergencies and how they will be addressed. That gambit was blocked by an unexpected surge of opposition from nations not as willing to surrender their sovereignty to an unaccountable supranational organization as is Team Biden. The WHO's complete submission to the Chinese Communist Party line in the course of the COVID-19 pandemic may have been a factor. As its director general renews his bid for expanded powers, he is distancing himself a bit from Beijing, notably by expressing a willingness to consider afresh whether the COVID virus actually did come from a Chinese bioweapons laboratory. Watch this space as our Center for Security Policy has a major new study on that subject coming out next week. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Gordon Chang. We're discussing with him the latest conversations that have been taking place between the United States and China. And I think we agree that what the takeaway by the Chinese from those conversations has been an emboldening of China, not a diminution of their appetite for some kind of military operation against Taiwan and perhaps beyond. Gordon, one of the questions that I was just asking you to contemplate is, if the Chinese are spoiling for war, and I think you're right, it's pretty clear they are, do you think that that extends to a determination to invade Taiwan no matter what? Or do you think that what they will try to do is to win without fighting, as Sun Tzu says, and secure through a military operation, yes, but a blockade rather than a physical attack on the island, the end state that they seek there?
Everything is on the menu, Frank, but there are many different ways that this struggle could play out. So, for instance, some of the islands of Taiwan are no more than 5 or 6 miles from the Chinese coast. And so there is increasing talk about how Beijing would just grab one or two of those, or islands in the middle of the Taiwan Strait, which are strategically important. So any of those options are there. An embargo is also possible. The thing about an embargo, though, is that in order to be effective, the embargo has to cover an area that would include sovereign Japanese territory, especially the island of Yonaguni, which is basically on a clear day, you can see the island of Taiwan from Yonaguni, which is actually south of Taipei, 58 nautical miles from the main Taiwan island. So that would have to be inside of China's embargo. That would bring Japan into the fight. So there's always that as well. Any number of things can happen, Frank, and it's not so much just a conscious decision for China to invade Taiwan. It's also these intercepts that China is causing. The one on May 26th, where they got very close to a Royal Australian Air Force P-8A Poseidon, a reconnaissance craft, fired flares and chaff. Some of that was ingested into one of the two engines of the P-8, which could have brought that plane down. So China, you can see from what it's doing, could start a war, quote-unquote, accidentally. But it's not just the intercepts of the Australians, it's also the intercepts of American craft as well, both aircraft and vessels. So this is exceedingly dangerous because we know that the law of averages says one of these will become a fatal incident.
A flashpoint, for sure. Gordon, speaking of the Taiwan Strait, the Chinese announced recently that they were going to consider that to be an internal waterway of China, and that they were going to henceforth require those seeking to transit it or otherwise use such waters or airspace to get their permission for doing so. This is very similar to, of course, what they've previously said about the South China Sea. And I suspect there will be other parts of the Western Pacific that they will be similarly staking claims to in the days to come. Give us your readout on where we stand with this regard, and does that ratchet up further, as you see it, the likelihood of a conflict, perhaps, or miscalculation at the very minimum?
Yeah, the real test here will be whether the U.S. Navy continues its transits through the Taiwan Strait. Under the Biden administration, freedom of navigation operations have increased. And I think that's not only because the Biden team is worried, but it's also because China's been more provocative. And clearly, these most recent statements that the Taiwan Strait is internal Chinese water, blue national soil, indicates that we'll have to see what the Biden administration will do. But it's clear to me that what we need to do is to have increased transits and transits by carrier strike groups. Because that needs to make the message to China that this still is international water and that we defend freedom of navigation. But we have not seen a freedom of navigation operation since those Chinese statements of 3 or 4 days ago.
Yeah, we'll be watching this closely, as obviously will the Chinese. Unfortunately, again, probably further emboldened if they are not forthcoming. Gordon, let me ask you about a report out of Stockholm, the so-called Stockholm International Peace Institute. SIPRI has done a report indicating that the Chinese are building up their nuclear capabilities. I think they're understating, frankly, the magnitude of that buildup, but it takes note of what is a important strategic development, it seems to me. What's your reading on the magnitude of what the Chinese are doing with their nuclear forces? We've been hearing about these 300 and some missile silos with the expectation that each of them might have a 10 warhead intercontinental range missile installed in them in due course. This would be a very, very dramatic buildup indeed of the Chinese military capabilities, especially in the nuclear space, would it not?
Well, certainly. And whether or not all 345 or so of those silos are filled, even if some are just decoys, we know that China is rapidly building up its nuclear arsenal faster, perhaps, than we have seen any country do this in history. The issues here are a number of them, including China's failure to be transparent about this, because both Russia and the United States publicly declare their operational warheads. And also China's refusal to engage with any other country in arms control discussions. Those also are critical. But the thing that I find that something that we can control is modernizing our triad. All three legs of that are outdated. And although there are some modernization efforts underway, they are inadequate compared to not only the Chinese, but also the Russian arsenals. So this really is an issue for the United States.
To say nothing of the combination of the two, which is...
To say nothing of the combination of the two. And we have to be concerned that they will fight together, because they have been, since 2005, drilling their militaries together. The pace of those exercises between China and Russia have increased recently, as well as the scope of what they are doing. So this is, we have to assume that they are both going to support each other. As we see, for instance, with China's support for Ukraine, we can see even more direct support from Russia on a Chinese incursion or invasion of some sort along its periphery.
Yeah. And I think the fact that among those exercises are simulated thermonuclear attacks against this country is the sort of thing that ought to be very much concentrating our mind. Gordon, very quickly and lastly, the administration has announced that it intends to use the Defense Production Act to build out our own capacity to produce solar power arrays. The it's simultaneously, amazingly, it's saying to the Chinese, you know, we're going to remove tariffs on their imports of these things. Does this make any sense at all to you?
Not much. On balance, this is a huge win for China because the waiver of the tariffs on solar panels for 24 months basically devastates American industry. As a friend of mine who's in the industry says, this really is a dog whistle to American companies across the board, not just solar panels, that the Biden administration will do nothing to help them to move their production off of Chinese soil. So basically, it stopped American companies from moving their supply chains here. It also, by the way, undercut American law by interfering in this Commerce Department investigation. So this is a real win for China.
A win for China, a loss for the United States. It seems to be the leitmotif of this administration. Gordon Chang, thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again with updates soon, if you would. Next up, we're going to be speaking with Todd Benzman, one of our duty experts on border insecurity and the dangers associated therewith. He's going to give us an update on the surge that is headed our way and what it will mean for you right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our go-to guys on matters involving border security and immigration issues more generally. His name is Todd Benzman. He has an extraordinary background, an investigative reporter by training. He served as an intelligence officer in the Department of Public Safety in Texas. And he has been, of late, the National Security Fellow for an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He has a terrific book on these issues, America's Covert Border War, and a new one forthcoming. We're waiting with bated breath for its arrival in the fall of this year. Todd Benzman, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Good to be here. Thanks.
You had a piece yesterday indicating that there's a little bit of good news on the Mexican side of the border with respect to the surge. And I must say, I hadn't expected to have any good news from you, but tell us what the latest is, thanks in part, at least, to Governor Greg Abbott in Texas.
Right. Well, recently, a caravan, the largest in history, 15,000 had formed down in southern Mexico, and the caravanners were on their way to the Del Rio sector of the Texas border. The Mexican government enabled that caravan to proceed by issuing thousands and thousands of humanitarian visas that allowed them to proceed finally to their northern border. When they got to the state of Coahuila, which is just across from the Del Rio, Texas area, Eagle Pass area, which is where they all wanted to cross, they ran into a buzzsaw. And what it was is state police were conducting road check, roadblock operations. They were in bus stations, pulling migrants off buses, turning buses around. Any road that went into this region was blocked, and the migrants removed and deported to the southern, to the next southern state. And this is a really unusual thing to have happen. Usually, you know, the Mexicans just kind of let them pass through like a turnstile. What it turned out to be, I found out, is that Governor Greg Abbott had cut a deal with the governor of Coahuila that they have to crack down on migrants or the governor's going to close down the bridges, the international bridges that bring in most of Mexico's export into the United States. They'd done that.
And that, of course, is something he'd done earlier in the year, in April.
That's right. Yeah, he had shut it down for three or four days by using vehicle safety inspections. They would get a couple of Texas DPS guys to spend a lot of time on each truck, really thoroughly checking it, and until they cried uncle and said, okay, we'll stop the immigrants. This is an innovative, interesting, new kind of thing. I don't know how ultimately effective it's going to be, but we know that as that caravan was forming, Governor Abbott was going to the governor of Coahuila and saying, hey, remember that bridge thing we did? That's going to happen again if you don't, you know, knock this thing out. And they are doing that right now. Lots of those operations called Operation Mirror.
So it's not necessarily a commutation of sentence, shall we say, but it is a stay of execution, at least for a bit here. And it speaks to the necessity, really, of these governors acting if the federal government of the United States is going to be so indifferent at best and at worst, a very considerable part of the problem. Todd, I wanted to ask you about one other thing that you've been reporting on. It's a very troubling facet of what you've talked about in your book, America's Covert Border War, namely the real threat from south of the border or points further removed coming across that southern border of, well, jihadists, among other possible national security threats. The FBI has been involved in a case revolving around an Iraqi national. Tell us the backstory there. What's it about, and what does it suggest about the larger problem?
Well, very recently, the FBI and DOJ broke up a plot to assassinate the former president, George W. Bush, in Texas. The alleged perpetrator is now under arrest and under indictment out of Ohio, was plotting to bring 8 ISIS assassins in over the Mexican border through Brazil, just like I write about in the book, on those trails through the Darien Gap jungle into Mexico and then on up into the very broken border. And luckily, they got a couple of FBI informants in next to the guy and were able to break the plot up. But it was a real plot. The ISIS operatives were real people. The court records talk about how this Iraqi asylum seeker, who's based out of Ohio, actually had already moved in 2 Hezbollah operatives before this case even got going, hoping that they're trying to chase those down and figure out where they are. But what this really, the broader takeaway here about that case is that it shows that the bad guys recognize our border is in utter chaos and extremely vulnerable, and an opportunity. It represents an opportunity to do things like this. And I think that's the big takeaway from this. This is a very complicated and interesting case overall. I don't have time to go into all the details of it, but I will be following this case looking for more disclosures in the court records.
Yeah. Well, again, this is the thing that distinguishes your reporting on these challenging times, Todd Bensman, and it's so appreciated. You actually have got the expertise to follow the trails where they lead and to shed light on them as not hypothetical problems, but very real world ones. And I want to just draw you out on something because it's weighing on me tremendously. And that is that, as we've discussed before, a very substantial portion of those immigrants are unaccompanied military age men. And how many of them, whether they've got, you know, drug cartel backgrounds or whether they've got other jihadist or dangerous qualities to them, is anybody's guess. But the fact that they've been turned loose inside the United States in huge numbers, and for that matter, disseminated all over the place as well, has to constitute a national security threat. And you're one of the few people who both is covering this story day in and day out as a public policy challenge of the first order, but has the expertise to help, as they say, connect the proverbial dots on the national security side as well. Tell us a little bit more about how significant you see that problem being beyond this this microcosmic example of this case, the Iraq.
Yeah, this is very, very concerning what's happening right now at the border. By filings in a court case, which I won't get into the details of, we actually have a line of sight on how many have gotten through gotaways. And it looks like we're up to about 750,000 gotaways reach the border and got through without being arrested of any in any way. And that's always going to be an undercount because it's very the Border Patrol is very conservative in the way that they tally these. But the people that are largely getting away are single adults, a great many of them men. I just had somebody telling me yesterday about operations out in the Douglas, Arizona area, where hundreds and hundreds of, they dress them in camouflage, of young men are pouring over the wall, the fence, right in that area. And that the vast majority of these are people with very serious criminal histories. They're running and they're paying huge sums of money to get through that area because if they get caught, they likely will be returned. But high-level criminal history people are pouring over this border right now because there really is no deportation beyond the Border Patrol zone of about 100 miles. The Biden administration, I want to emphasize this, the Biden administration has eliminated deportations in America of even the most serious criminals, violent criminals, sex offenders, pedophiles, rapists, armed robbers, murderers. They are no longer deporting them. The Supreme Court recently ruled that they can't do that anymore. There are court cases winding through that are going to reverse that. But in the meantime, you know, God, tons have gotten through and they're going to be here. We're going to live with this problem for a long time.
Well, living is the best case. Unfortunately, there's a distinct possibility some of us are not going to live as a result of what these people might have in mind for us. Yeah, and Todd, again, this is such vital work that you've been doing at the Center for Immigration Studies. I thank you for it. As I say, your book, America's Covert Border War, is really required reading, and the new one will be, I'm sure, every bit as much so, and we're looking forward to having a proper celebration of your new bestseller. Tell us the name of it again.
Right now, it's called Overrun, and it's about this border crisis.
It says it all. Come back to us again with updates, Todd, as soon as you can, if you would, please. In the meantime, keep up the great work and carry on. Next up, Kevin Freeman joins us. We'll talk with him a bit about, the budget disaster heading our way as a result of inflation right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last month, the World Health Organization sought with the help of the Biden administration to secure sweeping new powers to dictate what constitute public health emergencies and how they will be addressed. That gambit was blocked by an unexpected surge of opposition from nations not as willing to surrender their sovereignty to an unaccountable supranational organization as is Team Biden. The WHO's complete submission to the Chinese Communist Party line in the course of the COVID-19 pandemic may have been a factor. As its director general renews his bid for expanded powers, he is distancing himself a bit from Beijing, notably by expressing a willingness to consider afresh whether the COVID virus actually did come from a Chinese bioweapons laboratory. Watch this space as our Center for Security Policy has a major new study on that subject coming out next week. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. And when we talk about welcome, I always have a special place in my heart for our next guest. His name is Kevin Freeman. He is most welcome because he brings to this program a wealth of expertise in a portfolio that, frankly, not enough of us have a grasp of. It's called economic warfare. It is the subject of his own television program, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman on Blaze TV and other platforms. It's the subject of his two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. It is the focus of his blog, theglobaleconomicwarfare.com. And it is, of course, an abiding passion for him that he helps the rest of us understand and, I think, get, well, early warning about. And one of the things that Kevin has been warning of now for some time is the condition of our economy and its dependence upon very low interest rates, as well as the reserve currency status of the dollar to essentially enable us to persist in profligate spending and all that flows from that. Kevin's been warning for some time that the chickens would come home to roost, and it appears as though that has just happened. Kevin Freeman, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have you with us, my friend.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be with you.
So, yesterday, the Federal Reserve Board announced the largest interest rate increase in decades. What's going on? What does that entail most immediately? And what will it precipitate in your judgment?
Oh, Frank, that's a very big question. The Federal Reserve did raise interest rates. It is inevitable. It's something we have talked about for a long time. But the reason is simple. The inflation rate is reported over 8%. 8.6%, I think, is the official. And the net result of it is if you have 8+% inflation and interest rates were, you know, not long ago in the 2% range, you have people losing money and you have the economy spiraling into a potential hyperinflation. And so the Fed has to put the brakes on somewhere. They have to raise interest rates. They did it in a large measure, but a lot of people were saying maybe they should have raised 1% or more yesterday. And the implications of that are huge.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those implications, Kevin, because it's not just, you know, mortgage payments or credit card interest rates that are precipitated in a knock-on effect. Is that right? And what specifically are you most worried about in that regard?
Well, absolutely. I mean, credit card rates, depending on who you are, could have been 0% or they could have been 12 or 14%. But mortgage payments, interest rates are going up dramatically there. So the housing boom bubble is threatened. But the most important implication, I believe, is the fact that our federal government was on average paying 1% to 2% in interest on a $30 trillion debt. So that's, you know, $300 billion to $600 billion. If interest rates were to rise to the level that we've seen in our lifetimes, which is 10% plus, or even if they were just to get to the inflation rate of 8% plus, you're talking $2.4 trillion of government spending only on interest, solely on interest, not covering our military, not covering Social Security, not covering salaries for the federal workers or any of the other things that our federal government does. That is devastating for an economy. That's where the inflation rate implies that the interest rates are headed. And if that were to happen, it would be a very severe shock to the system and maybe an end of the modern American economy as we know it.
All right. Walk us through that a little bit more systematically. $2.4 trillion just to service the debt on a net income of what?
Yeah, we're a little over $4 to $5 trillion. I haven't looked at it lately, but let's say $5 trillion. That's half of everything taken in, and I don't think we're taking that much in. I think it's a little over $4 trillion. But the point being, we have all this other spending we have to do, and we were already running a deficit. So now we're talking about adding to the debt annually, and it spirals. It just imagine if you were a household and you were spending. But half of your income was going to make the interest payment on your credit cards. And then you still have to pay your mortgage. You still have to pay the electric bill, which is spiraling out of control. You have all of these things. A hyperinflation is how major nations dissolve. It's been the death knell for real societies, whether Weimar Germany or whether Zimbabwe or Argentina or Venezuela. And that is where we're headed if we don't address it quickly.
Well, there are a couple of pieces of this that I want to tease out. One is obviously among the things that would apparently go over the side in terms of discretionary spending that would not be affordable if roughly half of our income is going to service the debt and the preponderance, I guess, of the rest of it is for fixed obligations of the government, whether it's, you know, Social Security payments or other, you know, entitlements, as they're called. Obviously, we're at a moment, as we talk about on this program incessantly, where it looks as though there's a distinct possibility we're going to need that military to defend us against threats, notably from the Chinese Communist Party. It's unimaginable, Kevin, that we could find ourselves in a situation where we simply can't afford to pay the troops, let alone, you know, modernize their kit and acquire additional weapons that they may need for combat.
Well, the answer is, if we were able to do it, we'd have to borrow that money. The question is, where would we borrow it from? And the idea is that if our enemies decided that they no longer wanted to fund us, and the Chinese have been buyers of our debt in the past, it puts us at mercy of other nations. And it puts us at risk of you either cut your defense, which will ruin your nation, or you continue to borrow and spend, which could cause inflation. I mean, we're in a very bad position.
I want to ask you to hold that thought, Kevin, because a bad position is, of course, what you've been telling us we were going to get into here. We're going to try to figure out what we do about it on the other side of a very short break with Kevin Freeman, our duty expert, senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and expert on economic warfare, Noam Parai. Stay tuned for more with Kevin right after this. Welcome back. Kevin Freeman is in the house virtually. I'm pleased to say he is the sponsor, the host, the driving force behind a really important program. It's called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. I'm very proud of both the content of those programs, and I've been privileged to be on them a number of times myself, but also the battle plans that Kevin and his team put together for each program. They're indispensable. They really take the important insights and teaching that he does in the course of the show and help you operationalize what you've learned and hopefully be better equipped to deal with some of the economic warfare challenges we're facing as a country. Kevin, you were talking about a world of hurt that we are getting ourselves into here, or have gotten ourselves into, maybe more accurately. One of the ways, as you've pointed out now for years, that we've kind of sustained our habit, if you will, of this excessive spending and debt aggregation without the kind of consequences before now that you're forecasting, is through printing more money, because we've had the reserve currency of the world for many years now. That may be coming to a halt. You've, again, been warning about that for some time. Talk a bit about how what you've just described in terms of this intensifying pressure on the dollar for us to be able to continue engaging in that kind of practice and float the boat.
Yeah, no, Frank, here's the irony. The U.S. dollar right now appears very strong in international markets, and yet we're losing 8.6% a year to inflation in the true purchasing power of the dollar. So it looks strong, and it looks strong temporarily because people during tough times will rush to the dollar, and they'll do that until they don't. Right now, you know, there's a war in Ukraine. Okay, rush to the dollar. Well, people who have money in the stock market, let's get out of stocks and let's buy treasury bonds. And so there's a strength to the dollar, but in the long run, when you have 8.6% inflation, when you have, I don't know what else to call them, adversaries, enemies like China that are holding our debt, that could dump the debt at their choice, when you have the need to borrow continuously an extra $1 trillion or $2 trillion or $3 trillion in a hyperinflation or $5 trillion a year for a federal government that's spending more than it's taking in, you have pressures long term on the dollar. And what happens if we lose that reserve currency status? The only reason that the United States is able to hold up at this moment with our spending patterns and inflation and everything else is because most people around the world, when they want to hold extra currency or cash, they'll want to put it in the U.S. dollar. At that same time, China, Russia, maybe even India, certainly Iran, North Korea, and others are questioning whether the dollar is long-term viable with this debt. They look down the road and say, well, you know, you used to be a wealthy nation, but you're not so much anymore. And so they're questioning, or they're purposing to target the dollar, to remove as the reserve currency. The effect of that would be devastating. We would have to live not like Americans, but like Venezuelans at that point. Hyperinflation would destroy our economy. So this is a very significant subject. I don't think it's going to happen anytime immediately soon, but it is certainly on the minds of many of our adversaries, enemies, people around the world saying, can the dollar remain the place we put our extra money? And if it's not the place we put our extra money, the implications are dire, because we've got to immediately begin to change some of our policies.
Kevin, you've referred several times to the Chinese as our unlikely benefactors in all of this, holding a large percentage of our debt, you know, perhaps being willing to buy more of it, despite the fact that hostilities with China seem not out of the question by any means. Just can you give us a rough order of magnitude what we would wind up paying the Chinese more if we wind up having to, cover the costs of all of this debt? At a higher interest rate. Would this be yet another an enormous financial windfall for China under these circumstances?
Well, you know, China, when we began talking, Frank, you know, 15 years ago or whatever, China held about $1 trillion of our debt. And most recently, they hold about $1 trillion of our debt. They've not, actually not increased. They've as a percentage of our overall debt, because we went from having, you know, when the Bush administration ended, it was about $10 trillion. Today, it's about $30 trillion. So they own 10%. Now they own about 3%. They will get a windfall if interest rates on $1 trillion are at a 2% rate, like they were recently. That we're paying them about $20 billion a year for that. If interest rates go to 8%, we'll be paying about $80 billion a year. So yes, there will be a dramatic increase. But I think it's interesting to note that China has not increased in percentage terms of the outstanding debt hardly at all. In fact, they have slowly let the percentage of our debt decrease and the percentage of their holdings decrease, which is a quiet dumping of their holdings, as something we warned that they might do and something that we're seeing them do.
Well, and I guess maybe it's not such a bad thing. If they are our mortal adversaries, you just as soon not have them have their hand around your throat in that respect. Kevin, just very quickly, you've talked a little bit about the stock market being a place that people are feeling very nervous about at the moment. It's been on a nosedive. Very quickly, is your judgment that there is an end in sight here? And most especially, and very quickly, if you could, should we be investing in China instead?
No, we should not be investing in China. I believe that they may be our mortal enemy, and therefore we shouldn't. In the U.S., if we change policies, if we get pro-growth policies, if we reduce the size of government relative to the size of private industry, if we get people patriotic and feeling good about America again, it would be a great buying opportunity. I never count out the United States of America. The question is, will we reverse political course?
Will we reverse political course in time, I think, is the further precipitation factor here. Kevin, thank you very much for your insights, as always. The work you do at Economic War Room, as I say, is indispensable. We look forward to talking with you again next week. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Appreciate you watching, and I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.